There are so many extraordinary people living in our area. My name is Galen Joseph Hunter, and I had the great fortune to sit down with artist Allison Knowles this past Saturday. Allison Knowles is a visual artist known for her sound works, installations, performances, and books. As a founding member of Fluxus, Knowles produced a pioneering book object, a can of text and beans called the Bean Rolls in 1963. Knowles has produced an important body of sound objects. Her bean turners are constructed from beans and paper and are both book pages and sonic instruments. Distinct from her prodigious events and live performances, Knowles has been active in sound since the late 1960s. In 1968, she designed and co-edited John Cage's Notations, a book of visual music scores for the Something Else Press. Her Bean Garden, 1971, installed at Charlotte Mormon's annual New York Festival of the Avant-Garde, amplified the sounds of people walking over a large platform covered with beans. And just recently, this year, Knowles offered her iconic performance, The Identical Lunch, to museum visitors as part of the Museum of Modern Art's Performance Exhibition Series. Here's a 30-minute conversation that took place at Wave Farm in Accra this past Saturday. I'm Galen Joseph Hunter, and I'm sitting here with Allison Knowles. I'm very fortunate to be sitting here with Allison Knowles, and you've brought some instruments.
Okay, so my instruments are start off historically with my interest in beans, because at the time when I was encountering abstract expressionism with Adolf Gottlieb and all those wonderful people at Pratt were trying to teach me to paint, I realized that I probably wasn't a painter, and also I was interested in bringing live materials into the situation of art, and at the same time being involved with performance.
Right.
And I'd had the chance to do some, a little further on in life, some radio, Hörspiels,
called. Yep.
So I began to incorporate something real for me, which became beans, with paper. And then a little after that, I met Amanda Degener and Eugenie Baron, who helped me actually fabricate instruments. So we call this a bean turner. And this is made of abaca. And the shape, isn't that beautiful?
It is.
The shape is formed by air. It's like human hands do not touch. The paper is poured out flat, and then with the right width, thickness, it begins to torque. And then at a certain point, this pocket is opened up, which has a piece of plastic in it. And beans are put in. And I often begin a performance of poetry with some reading from, I have a number of books out. I'll read part of it, but then I'll say, well, the North Wind was actually in Nova Scotia in July, not so great. I mean, I'm reading and I'm singing. So that's a finished instrument. But before that, to go back, I made several other types. Eugenie didn't make this. I think it's an anime. I'm very fond of this one. It's made from a knitter's wooden circle, which is then crossed with wool. And she begins to knit something, which she then springs off the circle.
Okay. So, and what is the exterior material
this
there?
This is flax. Well, that's the only paper I use. Because it's not only resonant, but it's very strong. So this can become a drum. Kind of an endless kind of sound.
Yeah.
And this one was the very first object that I made with an artist named Helmut Becker.
What year is that about?
I went up in the 80s to Canada, and it's quite coming apart now. And it's made over a temple chime that I got in Tokyo when I had a residency there. And I took this metal disc, which was a temple chime, and people would come and gong it before they did a meditation. And so I discovered that this flax paper, it's the only paper that has any resonance like this. Cotton, abaca. But I took this in terms of doing performance art and added this.
So that's a selection of beans, lentil, and there's some red and black.
I just did that really to show you that I know the beans pretty well, and they have different sounds. Mm-hmm. But I kind of mix them here. This is, of course, a red kidney and red lentil and black kidney or black beans. And if I have a video pickup over my head, that's very nice.
Sure, yeah. I can imagine. Gosh, I wonder how quick people would be to be able to recognize that sound as beans without knowing in advance.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
No, it could be water.
Yeah. So is your use of beans, I mean, you've been working with beans for like 4 decades now, right?
I started out with a Something Else Press in 1958 or so, and we lived in Chelsea, 238 West 22nd Street, and I had the chance to meet a lot of European artists, which we had met previous summer in Germany and France.
Mm-hmm.
So I could have these people over for dinner, and also I was busy having my own artwork first exhibited here and there in New York in small galleries, but I had to take care to keep it going. And we had this wonderful house at 22nd Street, so I had the whole top floor, and I rented half of it for some income, and wonderful artists like Ben Patterson and Robert Filiou and Emmett Williams passed through. Maybe you don't know these people.
I do. Yeah.
Passed through 238 West 22nd Street, and I could do pieces with them. I've done pieces with both Emmett and Robert in Europe, and I just felt as if that's it. I'm some kind of performance artist with sound. But then as time moved along, we had to leave 22nd Street, and we moved to, well, actually we moved from Canal Street to 22nd Street, but always in New York, and always I had access to these artists who were passing through New York. I lost my thread there.
I think you were talking about the origin of beans as your
right, there
medium.
You go. That I had to feed all these people a couple of nights a week, and I became pretty efficient cooking beans. And I was very happy to do that. Because I find food within a context of art making and familiarity with other people is very important.
Sure, yeah. So is the, in reading about your work, there's a lot of talk about the symbolism of the beans and what beans can represent and the commonness of bean. And is that, do you feel that's something that you address or think about that's intentional, or is it kind of just as you were feeding lots of people and beans was a natural reference that you came upon.
I think both would be true. Yeah. That once I was feeding all these people, it's...
I love it. Every once in a while, it just explodes and the beans come up.
My poor friend, Eugenie Baron, you know, we've been sweeping lentils off the floor all day. I'm doing these pieces, dropping lentils into paper.
Uh-huh.
So I have some finished pieces with lentils. I think the combination of... I was involved with the 1958 Cage class,
mm-hmm.
and not in it, but Dick Higgins was in it.
Mm-hmm.
And from that inspiration, he started something called the Something Else Press.
Right.
So then I realized I had the opportunity to publish work, which most 30-year-old women do not have, especially if they haven't been writing since mm-hmm. they were born. So I began to write small books, Natural Assemblage of the True Crow, and he had a series of Great Bear pamphlets, and I contributed to that.
Mm-hmm.
But the influence of the Cage class cannot be overstated, because George Brecht, Jackson McLoe, Dick Higgins were mm-hmm. in that class,
yeah.
Florence Tarlow. Does that name?
I don't know Florence's name.
Yeah, she's a wonderful actress. So that's how I came to know Cage and mm-hmm. to begin working on this, I think, very quite important book.
The Notations.
Notations.
Yeah.
And the association with him brought us into a whole avant-garde where we were performing all the time and helping other people do their work. And this period doesn't exist anymore, so I really value my memory of it.
Mm-hmm.
The next, I think, important venture that we engaged with was in Germany at the Wiesbaden Festivals of 1962, mm-hmm. 72, 82. Again, that's something this country seems slow to pick up on, is if you have a really great festival in 2080, then how about 2081,
yeah.
too? In other words, you keep an energy going,
yeah.
and other people can join in, and other people drop out. Or
did you feel any of that with the Charlotte Mormon festivals, or was that just such a different scale?
It was such a different thing. Yeah. Charlotte Mormon Festival was mostly about Charlotte Mormon, and it was an opportunity to do something, but it was always kind of sandwiched in between great figures.
Mm-hmm.
She was very susceptible to, important people coming in, and the important person would take over most of the time.
Mm.
And they were difficult because many of them were outdoors on the mm-hmm, beach. Or,
mm-hmm.
I commend her for doing them at all in this country.
Yeah, yeah.
And people would come out to these festivals, but it wasn't like being supported by Westerman Radio.
Yeah.
Where, 3 days of hotel, food, bring a friend, and take as long as you want with our technicians to get what you want. And
it's amazing.
I just never had any dates in the United States which could equal the finesse and the technical perfection of what I could do on West German radio.
Yeah. We don't have the technical perfection by any means, but that's something that we're really striving for with these Saturday programs.
No, it doesn't exist anywhere.
Yeah, and there's no, to my knowledge, there's really no terrestrial station in the country that's making space for really anything experimental.
Public radio in New York is pretty well established people,
and, yeah,
humorous people and song and dance people, yeah. And they do try. I think they try, but it's not as if there's any dedication in a direction that has to do with serious culture.
It's tricky. I mean, we've been on the air for 2 months, and all of a sudden, this content that doesn't strike me as being so avant-garde or so far from what is considered normal, is I'm starting to really understand what it sounds like to people who aren't invested in the avant-garde or the experimental. And it's an interesting experience. And
you get some phone calls, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, trying to reconcile that too in being a local station. And it's interesting because when we talk about transmission art, we look back to Fluxus and we see a lot of, we think there's a tremendous amount of influence there, but it's all in this idea of anti-art or rejecting kind of the
traditional.
I feel like there's that quality here in what radio artists are doing today, but there's also using art as a cloak of safety and protection and sort of defense mechanism. And I don't know if that's because we're 50 years later or if it's...
I think culture is in a more fearful...
Yeah.
A far fearful place.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Fundamentally for finances and also with the Republican Party coming closer and closer to our door.
Yeah.
That a lot of ideas one could work with are could not only not be aired, but who would your listeners be often?
Yeah.
It's a very different time. It's a scary time, as far as I'm concerned. It's a scary time.
Yeah, I agree. I've completely sidetracked us. So back to the beans. So tell me more about how, let's see. Tell me about your recent series at MoMA. How was that?
Oh, that was great. That just shows you that you can't foretell. I mean, my goodness, Megan called me up. Megan Wagner, and she said, well, we're doing a whole performance series here and we want to begin with the Identical Lunch. And I almost dropped the phone. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, it's something we could launch here. We have a cafeteria and we could plan a series of lunches in the cafeteria if you'd be interested, and we could begin the series with what we feel to be a rather significant performance piece from 58, 59. And I have a couple of books called The Identical Lunch.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a great time. She overextended the guest list, so I didn't have a chance to invite actually any of my friends. I was apologizing to Eugenie today that I was invited one or two guests for the whole series.
Wow.
They had all their trustees, first of all,
uh-huh.
and then they had their curators, secondly. So they said, well, you know, there is one seat. Would you like to have somebody come?
So, do you want to describe The Identical Lunch for our listeners? They may have a hint by the title, but...
All right. But there was a film. It's a lovely film that was made by Brandon Kroll, a young filmmaker. And so I do have that record of people walking into the cafeteria and a waitress coming up to each of the people at a 12-seated table and saying... And what will you have? And the lunch was printed on a tablecloth of a vinyl
mm-hmm.
and adhered to the table. So they just had to read what was on a circle on the table, which is a tuna fish sandwich on wheat toast
mm-hmm.
with lettuce and butter, no mayo, and a cup of soup or a glass of buttermilk. So what they had a chance to say to the waitress, to Tracy, was, I'll have the soup. What is the soup today? And she could say, oh, it's carrot, tomato. Or so there was a little dialogue with the waitress and the person having the lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And then those lunches would arrive exactly as planned. And then there would be, the lunch tables were maybe slightly wider than this, so you're really faced with the person opposite you to talk with,
mm-hmm.
or either side. They were great.
And was there a part of the cafeteria that was isolated off, or was it in the midst of all of the public?
Yeah. And that was the only problem with the film and with the actual dialogue that we picked up was that it was right in the middle of the cafeteria. So you had these voices and you had... but the film is very nice because I go behind the counter and oversee the making of the sandwich the first time, and that was caught on film.
Oh, nice.
So
is the film screening around, or it's just...
I have it on disc, I do. I haven't looked at it, I've had it a couple of days only. But it is the only record I have. Because the film was made by this Brandon Kroll, and it was put onto disc by Josh Selman. Joshua Selman is my son-in-law.
Okay.
And I think it's quite a stunning event, considering that the MoMA would accept it as a piece of art.
Mm-hmm.
Just eating your sandwich.
Yeah.
You know? But the whole dialogue of deciding on these small matters of the soup or the buttermilk.
Mm-hmm.
Almost nobody had buttermilk. And buttermilk is kind of a dated food.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go into most cafes and get any buttermilk.
Sure, yeah.
But when I was doing this piece and taking people for lunch at this one Riss Food place where the books were made and where the accounts were made, every cafe had buttermilk. So that was interesting that as I looked over the tables during the lunches at the MoMA, a couple of buttermilks, that's all.
Yeah, I've never had it just straight now.
They were adventurous people.
They saw a great meaning in that buttermilk, I'm sure.
So we kept that going there, and then I went to teach in California.
Oh, yeah, where?
Cal Arts. Yeah. From 70 to 72. So I kept the lunches going there, but students would do them and make a document for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my entrance to Paul Brock and Alan Capra's class.
Mm-hmm.
So I could offer the lunch out there, which of course was really impossible to do because they don't make wheat toast in California. You have to get a roll.
Really?
Oh, they don't have any wheat bread unless you've got, it's very hard. But we managed to carry on some performances there.
So would you say it was 70 to 72? I'm trying to remember when Capra's Hello piece is. I think maybe that's a little later, 74 maybe. Do you know that piece I'm talking about? The Hello, the video transmission piece?
I'm trying to think what piece I was in of his, but that was actually in New Jersey before we went out there. I liked his work because always it was kind of airy and outdoors and rangy. And I wouldn't say it was within the Fluxus Event Score tradition in any way. He'd love it if it would rain or go wrong or snowed or something didn't arrive. It was all built on happenstance.
Mm-hmm.
And, right. But anyway, he was the head of the department at CalArts, so I had a lot of license to do outdoor lunches, or I built this work called The House of Dust, which is based on a computer program.
Oh, right, of course, yeah.
And so I built this fiberglass house, which was a way for the students to get out of CalArts, which was kind of like we called it the Dow Chemical Building.
Oh, really?
An uglier building you never saw.
I guess I've never actually been on their campus.
God, it's bad. But anyway, they had an excellent... particularly, I think, movie, film, and art department.
Mm-hmm.
The performance, I think we did something with it, but performance art, you know, for me it came in 62 in Wiesbaden, when I went over to Germany and the state and the museum in Wiesbaden actually sponsored people from like four or five countries to come and do performance art on the stage of a very fine museum, which never happened in this country, at least not within those years. And now the MoMA like catches up, but
took a while.
A little after the fact.
Yeah. Well, we can keep trying.
I just think really whatever went on in Germany culturally was so devastatingly fantastic and brilliant and wonderful that artists could just step into serious culture without a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't have to have a PhD, and you could just, with a little work, get in, do something in a museum. And France a little bit too, but not quite to that extent.
Netherlands a little bit. I guess that's later.
Yeah. But again, the Hörspiel.
Yeah.
Radio play. That's Klaus Schoening.
Mm-hmm.
That's German, West German radio.
And I don't think really, was in the 80s, I think, that Radio Pacifica Radio started thinking about Hörspiel a little bit. But,
a little bit, maybe.
Yeah, but a lot later. So I don't think we mentioned when you were showing me the instruments that you're working in Durham on these pieces, or maybe you did, but that would probably be exciting for our listeners to know.
Oh yes, I go to Durham to work with an excellent paper maker named Eugenie Baron. I've worked with her for years, and she orders say 2 pounds of flax pulp, and I arrive and there are these pails, and they get poured into a beater, which is like a huge wearing blender.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes around and around for about 8 hours and gets this pulp so that it's like a thin slurry.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's poured out, and the either objects are put in or they become performance documents that I'm going to be using when I go to Virginia in a few weeks. I have a huge arm. Actually, I made it last week in Minneapolis. But you put your arm into the paper,
mm-hmm.
and the top of the paper makes a kind of wing that sounds and is transparent. So it's kind of you become a weird figure,
mm-hmm.
and then there's a hat and legs that go with it.
Wow.
And you actually become so encumbered with paper that someone has to walk you off the stage. And the sounds of the walking, because you have paper shoes. And I do that everywhere. I love to do that piece. It's
Where
called
in
Loose Pages.
Loose Pages. Where are you doing it in Virginia?
Charlottesville.
At a educational space? Or
Yeah. Charlottesville, it must be. Maybe it's a university. I don't know.
Amazing. Well, and then you spend a lot of time in... Do you have a place in Ulster County? Is that right?
I have a place in Barrytown.
Oh, in Barrytown, okay.
Which is
Dutchess County.
Kind of near Red Hook.
Yeah. Well, I went to Bard, so I know Barrytown.
You do?
Yeah.
Most people do not know Barrytown. So I have a shop there, but it's kind of like a barn and has a... I go to Eugenie for paperwork, mm-hmm. but what I can do there is print work. I can print on the papers that
mm-hmm.
we make.
Mm-hmm.
And I can take time to maybe do nothing and just walk down the hill where George Quasha lives
mm-hmm.
and go to something at Bard for fun. It's a really wonderful part of the world, Barrytown.
Yeah.
And I've missed it because I've been away and traveling, but I hope to be up there by mid-May.
Oh, good.
I'm going to see my daughter in Washington and my other daughter in Massachusetts, and I'll do performances in both of those situations.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I'll have to see about making a request for a performance in this neck of the woods, maybe.
Okay.
We'll see if we can talk you into it.
All right.
Well, I'll turn this off, and I'll tell our listeners first that I think they can expect more. And Bonnie Marenka is going to sit down with you this summer, I think, and talk to you.
Well, it was very nice to talk with you. I enjoyed it very much.
Well, thank you.
And we'll do it again.
Wonderful. Thank you.